And now, from the gay capital of the Western Hemisphere, KSAN San Francisco presents... The Gay Life. Good morning, I'm Randy Alfred. This morning on The Gay Life, we'll be talking to David Scott, the mayoral candidate and former president of the Board of Permit Appeals, about the SRI report on the May 21st riot, about the police, and about the balance of power in San Francisco. We also have a delightful interview with Quentin Crisp, who's now appearing with ACT in a one-man show, An Evening with Quentin Crisp. And as the first anniversary of November 27, 1978 rolls around, we're presenting again White Knight, Black Dish, a satiric audio montage of the events of last November and last May.
You who philosophize disgrace and criticize all fears, take the rag away from your face. Now ain't the time for your tears.
We want justice! 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 We want justice!
The Gay Life on KSAN presents White Knight, Black Dish, or the ultimate last fag joke. On the steps of City Hall on a rainy day in January 1978, gay leader Harvey Milk was sworn in as a supervisor of the city and county of San Francisco.
Harvey, please raise your right hand.
Do you, Harvey Milk, solemnly swear or affirm that you will support and defend the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of California against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that you will bear true faith and allegiance to the Constitution of the United States and the Constitution of the State of California, that you take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose of evasion, and that you will well and faithfully discharge the duties upon which you are about to enter and during such time as you hold the office of Supervisor, District Number 5.
I do. A moment of levity, Anita Bryant said gay people brought the drought to San Francisco, and look what's happening.
Harvey Milk spoke out about the police.
So they're lying. Blank, period. Exclamation point. They lie. They lie through their teeth. And until they stop that, they can't build up the trust. This phoniness, you know, sure, I don't think anybody who kills a cop should be put away and all that stuff. I think anybody who commits any kind of crime with a gun should get a hard penalty, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years, whatever. Lock them up, let them know. Any crime with a gun, no ifs, ands, buts about it, no parole, no extended mitigating circumstances, you commit a crime with a gun, any kind of crime, into the slammer. Bang.
As president of the Board of Supervisors, it's my duty to make this announcement. Both Mayor Moscone and Supervisor Harvey Milk have been shot and killed. The suspect is Supervisor Dan White.
Dan White. It's been driving me mad to tell you this. For the murder of one Italian, middle-class, allegedly heterosexual liberal mayor, and for the murder of one petty bourgeois Jewish faggot, and for staining the steps you trod on with the blood of these two, I promise you this. If you plead insanity, I promise you this. If you get off because of insanity, I promise you this. You will go stark, raving mad.
What's different? These stories, people just charging and taking money from big corporations and not recording it. I never did that. I never took money from anybody.
You never give me your money. You only give me your and I saw more and more evidence of this during the week when papers reported that someone else is going to be reappointed. I couldn't get through the mayor. The mayor never called me. He told me he was going to call me before he made any decision. He never did that.
You didn't try to call me.
Didn't have even the courtesy to call me or tell me that I wasn't going to be reappointed. And then I got kind of fuzzy and just my head didn't feel right. And then he said, well, I've had people in your district say they don't want you. And I reiterated what I had told them before, that these were people that had brought false charges against me, had been dogging me.
Thou shalt not kill.
Thou shalt not kill.
He sat down, he was talking, and nothing was getting through to me. It was just like a roaring in my ears. And he was in his office when I came into the supervisor's area, and I said, Harvey, can I talk to you? And he got up, or he was standing up, I can't remember, and he walked into the room, and I shut my door, and he and I were in there. And then I didn't even know what I was doing, and he just kind of smirked at me, as if to say, too bad. And then I just got all flushed and hot, and I shot him.
The killer awoke before dawn. He put his boots on. He took a face from the ancient gallery and he walked on down the hall. He went into the room where his sister lived, and then he paid a visit to his brother, and then he walked on down the hall, and he came to a door, and he looked inside. Father, yes, son, I want to kill you. Mother, I want to.
And worked hard and never cheated anybody I'm not a crook or anything.
I'm not a crook.
And when I was under this pressure at home and at night I couldn't sleep. I didn't sleep last night. I wasn't even with my wife in bed. I was on the couch because I didn't want to bother her. I couldn't sleep. I never even slept.
Now it's time to say good night. Good night. Sleep tight.
I just wanted to talk to him. That's all. And at least have him be honest with me and tell me why he was doing it. Not because I was a bad supervisor or anything, but. No, I never killed anybody before. I never shot anybody.
Mama just killed a man, put a gun against his head, pulled my trigger.
intended to hurt anybody. It's just that these past several months, it's got to the point I couldn't take it. And I never wanted a job for ego or, you know, perpetuate myself or anything like that. I was just trying to do a good job for the city.
He's a real nowhere man, sitting in his nowhere land, making all his nowhere plans for nobody.
Well, White's attorney Douglas Schmidt got the jury to call a double political assassination manslaughter. That can also be pronounced man's laughter. Schmidt's the kind of lawyer who could get a charge of forcible sodomy reduced to following too closely and tried in traffic court. In fact, if Milk and Moscone had lived, Schmidt would probably have charged them with unlawful interference with the bullets of an ex-police officer. White owns a junk food counter on Pier 39. You know, that's down in the tourist ghetto. And he actually claimed that junk food, Twinkies, do you believe that? Twinkies made him do it. Eat a Twinkie, kill a cop. That's what the angry graffiti said in San Francisco's gay neighborhoods. But now that gays are at the police academy, maybe that should be kill a Twinkie, eat a cop. But seriously, I mean very seriously, even before the verdict, Milk's successor, Supervisor Harry Britt, warned of the reaction that a lenient verdict might produce.
Our community has been very quiet during the Dan White trial, but there's no doubt we're very tired of hearing outpourings of sympathy for this pathetic man and hearing him portrayed as a victim, as a nice guy who ate too many candy bars. And certainly as we get toward the jury time, we are building anger toward Dan White.
What do you think might happen if Dan White were found guilty of a lesser offense, like manslaughter or something of that nature, as his defense attorneys are trying to get him off with that?
We'll have to deal with it when it comes up, but it will be something to deal with if it comes up. I like to think that justice will be done and to assume that that will happen until the time comes. But if the community perceives that Dan White is being treated other than justly because he happened to be a clean-cut ex-cop, then there will be a very serious reaction in the community.
In the courtroom of honor, the judge pounded his gavel to show that all's equal and that the courts are on the level and that the strings in the books ain't pulled and persuaded and that even the nobles get properly handled once that the cops have chased after and caught him, and that the ladder of law has no top and no bottom. Stared at the person who killed for no reason, who just happened to be feeling that way without warning. And he spoke through his cloak most deep and distinguished, and handed out strongly for penalty and repentance Williams and Zinger with a 6-month sentence. But you who philosophize disgrace and criticize all fears, bury the ray deep in your face, for now's the time for your tears.
Someone, and I believe it's Cleve Jones, who was one of the principal spokespeople for the gay community after the death of Harvey Milk, is trying to talk through a bullhorn, and I can barely hear him in one part of the crowd saying, "Harvey hated violence, please, no violence." But now the crowd is screaming, "Dan White's a pig." The TV lights are on the police who are standing in front of the center doors of City Hall. People are right up with their hands in the faces of those police chanting, "Dan White's a pig." Barricade of newspaper racks and trash dumpsters has been set on fire at the corner of Larkin and McAllister. Across the street, police cars are burning. And Police have gone through once on motorcycles to try to get people to stop, but it hasn't had much effect. Police cars have gone through here just a little while ago. People, the sound you hear in the background is the alarm sirens of burning police cars going off, and also the sound of people dragging newspaper racks and scavenger boxes into the middle of Larkin and McAllister streets and setting them on fire. There are 5 or 6 police cars burning that I can see with bright flames in front of the state office building. The police massing on the other side of the park haven't seemed to want to move over here yet. The fires are putting forth extremely thick smoke. And now some police motorcycle units have circled around to the Grove Street side. There's been no attempt by the fire department since their original attempt to get through here and to put out these fires, although we hear sirens in all directions. The barricades being set up now will effectively prevent the fire department from getting through, which is, I'm sure, exactly what the people building them have in mind. Four police cars in a row burning on this end of McAllister Street, 2 burning down the other end, 1 on this side of the street. Welcome over here, at least 7 police cars. The guy just walked by me and said, welcome to the 80s.
There is no question at all that there were a number of incidents last night in which police behaved very badly.
Supervisor Britt on the Elephant Walk incident on Castro Street the night of May 21st.
At some point during the evening, according to the reports that I have received, police officers entered that bar in force without any provocation that has been reported to me. There's a great deal of anger in the community when that sort of thing happens. The police did have no business on Castro Street. When I went down there last night and found hundreds and hundreds of police officers there, many of them from out of town.
And so the May 21st riot left San Francisco City Hall as the nation's finest example of boarded-up French Renaissance architecture. The next night, we had a peaceful birthday party for Harvey Milk on Castro Street. Riots one night and partying the next? Sure, it's the odd-even plan. On the other hand, it might have been in the stars. The sun had just entered Gemini, and that's a sign notorious for its juxtaposition of opposites. In fact, both Harvey Milk and Harry Britt are Geminis. Mayor Dianne Feinstein today fulfilled her solemn pledge to appoint a Gemini to succeed Gemini supervisor Harvey Milk. The news was greeted with jubilation in the city's large and influential Gemini community located atop Twin Peaks. Petitions are now being circulated to increase the number of supervisors from 11 to 12, so every sign has its soup. Well, D.A. Joe Freitas is prosecuting the people arrested in the riots. Too bad he doesn't assign the same prosecutors who handled the White case. In fact, there have been so many investigations of the riot that it's become a Castro Street status symbol to be subpoenaed. As Jerry Rubin once said, those who haven't been called are suffering from subpoenas envy. And then the police voted no confidence in Chief Gain. Now why should the police set city policy? They don't even live here. And now, a dramatization of an actual incident that occurred at the North Beach Photo Fair on the weekend following the verdict.
Mom? Who's the man in that picture?
That's the faggot they killed, Harvey Milk.
Who's that one, Mommy?
That's Moscone. They got him, too.
Why'd they kill him, Mom?
He was a commie.
Was Harvey Milk a commie?
I don't know.
Who killed him, Mommy?
Dan White. He's a fireman and policeman.
Yeah, and a murderer.
Don't say that. He's a good man from a good family.
Good men don't go around shooting people.
You shut up. I'm going to teach my kids to shoot anyone who tries to harm them, so get lost.
Well, at least she says what she thinks.
You've got to be taught to hate and fear. You've got to be taught from year to year. It's got to be drummed in your dear little ear. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught to be afraid of people whose eyes are oddly made and people whose skin is a different shade. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be taught before it's too late, before you are 6 or 7 or 8, to hate all the people your relatives hate. You've got to be carefully taught. You've got to be carefully taught.
The Gay Life on KSAN San Francisco has presented White Knight, Black Dish, or The Ultimate Last Fag Joke, starring, in order of appearance, Bob Dylan, Judge Ollie Marie Victoire, Harvey Milk, Dianne Feinstein, the fag nun Assunta Famia of the Sisters of Mercy and Vengeance, Dan White, an ex-cop, ex-fireman, and ex-supervisor, the Beatles, an ex-musical group, Frank Zappa and the Mothers of Invention, the Doors, Richard Nixon, an ex-president, Queen, Harry Britt, Larry Bensky, Gregory Lunsford, Susie Daniels, and William Tabbert. Our thanks to Nikos Diamond for the North Beach Photo Fair skit. White Knight, Black Dish was produced by Fred Green, edited by Rick Sadle, and written and narrated by Randy Alfred.
San Francisco will survive.
Our first guest this morning is David Scott, the former president of the Board of Permit Appeals, and the man who captured 10% of the vote in San Francisco's mayoral race a week and a half ago. Good morning, David.
Morning, Randy. Great to be here with you.
I'm glad we finally have you on the air. Just about the time I wanted to schedule you last spring, you became a candidate, and we came under the sway of the FCC's equal time provisions.
Well, then maybe we should get out the letter writers and have them write the FCC. So when you're a candidate, you can use some judgment and invite people in.
Well, perhaps. Speaking of judgment, seems that you're going to have to be doing a lot of that. You seem to hold the balance of power, as it were, in San Francisco politics at the moment, or at least seem to be the prime negotiator for the community in terms of what the people who voted for you expect to get from either of the other two candidates. But before we do that, I'd like to go back to the subject of White Knight, Black Dish that we just did, which is the riots of last May.
And right.
The SRI, formerly the Stanford Research Institute, has just issued a report called The May 1979 Riot in San Francisco, Police Issues, which has some interesting findings about the riot and I think also some interesting lack of findings. What's your overall impression of what the SRI report means about police practices in San Francisco?
Well, I think there are a lot of technical-type deficiencies that they addressed themselves to. There was a lack of loudspeakers. It was difficult to find shields for the police officers. There was lack of unified command coordination using radios and things of that tenor. The thing that struck me the most about the report was that the single incident that probably led to Chief Gain no longer being police chief was his support of Deputy Chief Mullins ordering men from Castro and Market Street at 2 in the morning on the 21st of May, 22nd of May. And the SRI report, in analyzing that entire incident, said it was a good use of police command, that the chief acted correctly, that the deputy chief acted correctly. And if, in fact, that incident is the result of us losing Chief Gain as our police chief, I think that the other mayoralty candidates ought to think seriously about maybe keeping Chief Gain, or at least committing themselves to appointing someone in the mold of Chief Gain who can rise above the demands of officers on an individual basis and do what's right not only for the officers but for the entire community of San Francisco.
Well, Mayor Feinstein is already committed to finding a chief from within the ranks. Do you think that there is anyone in the ranks who's in the mold of Chief Gain?
It's possible, but I'd like to look at their personnel files. I'd like to interview people that have known them for 5 or 10 or 15 years. I'd frankly like to have Chief Gain in on the process because he may know some junior officers who he has seen exhibit good leadership qualities in the sense of representing all the communities in San Francisco and not just the old boy network of police officers.
Well, one of the things that I found interesting about the SRI report was the way in which it admitted but almost glossed over the failure of the police to pick up the signals from the community, of which there were many, that violence was a definite possibility in the event of a manslaughter verdict. I know that Harry Britt spoke out
That's right.
to reporters from this station, and we just heard several minutes ago, we heard tape of him saying that. I know that Cleve Jones, who's a juvenile delinquency commissioner, and Lydia Schechtman, the editor of the Sentinel, visited Captain Jeffrey.
Absolutely.
The week before the riot and told him about it. I know that Lieutenant Dan Murphy told me on the night of the riot, at about 1 o'clock in the morning of the 22nd,
yes,
in the mayor's office, while the incident at the Elephant Walk was currently in progress, of course we didn't know about that at the time, that following the May 12th mini-riot on Castro Street, in which a couple of hundred people protested over the arrest of someone leafleting,
right,
for Guy Corey, a protest mayoral candidate.
Right. That was a Saturday afternoon.
A Saturday afternoon. Shouting Dan White's pig, throwing rocks and bottles, what by all intents and purposes was a mini-riot. Lieutenant Murphy told me that following that event, the police did not reassess their previously arrived at assessment that there was not likely to be much, mm-hmm, violence. Now, the SRI report glances over all of that in a couple of sentences and said they should have listened. They should have heard the report.
Certainly should have.
But some of the very people who were given those reports, it doesn't talk about where those reports failed to get passed on to the chief or failed to get passed on. Now, some of the very people who failed to pass that communication on, who are criticized not by name but implicitly in the SRI report, are currently candidates for chief of police in Mayor Feinstein's view. Isn't that what's going on?
Yes, and it's very unfortunate. In fact, I know that the mayor was notified on the previous Friday when she was swearing in Walter Jebby as a member of the Art Commission out at the Excelsior branch of the library. And one of the members of a neighborhood association, the president of a merchants group and vice president of the Neighborhood District Merchants Council, went to her and explained that these things might be happening. And this is a longtime supporter of the mayor's, not someone who is in any way an adversary or against her politically. And she didn't heed that advice. And interestingly enough, I asked Mr. Taylor of SRI if he'd asked the mayor during his interview.
Who was the chief author of the report.
That's correct. And I asked Mr. Taylor of SRI, since he was the only person that interviewed the mayor, if he'd asked the mayor if she ever had any previous knowledge or information about potential disorder, potential riots or demonstrations. He said he had not asked her that. And I think that from the outset of this report, it was try to smooth things over to some degree rather than point up where the real deficiencies were. I'm disappointed that question wasn't asked, especially because he was the project leader for the entire research project.
Well, as someone who received about 18,000 votes.
Yeah, a little more than that.
A little more than 18,000 votes. It's not necessarily true that you have a block of votes to deliver.
That's right. I don't see myself that way
at all. It's as if you've been in this choice, this final choice between Supervisor Kopp and Mayor Feinstein, as if you've been chosen to negotiate for a large segment of the gay community and for large segments of other liberal elements of the city's constituency.
Yeah, I don't see myself that way because I think many people who voted for me won't necessarily vote the way I might vote. I see myself as getting a significant amount of votes that have impact on the election. And the one thing I have is the ability to have access to Mrs. Feinstein and Mr. Kopp that the other 18,000 people don't have. And hopefully I can get them to speak out on issues that I think are important, such as who is going to be the next police chief, who is going to be on the police commission, are we going to continue to have full funding of city services? Proposition R. Will either of those mayoralty candidates agree not to veto a law changing our current rent control law that says when a rental unit turns over, it will not be decontrolled? That would be a significant concession from either of them. So I have an agenda that I would like to present to them, which the other 18,000 people don't have. They may not agree with what I'm doing, and I don't go out saying, here, I'm going to deliver something to you. But if I can make the candidates address themselves to the issues that I really believe in, I think that that's worth my time and effort.
Right. Well, if you wring some concessions, as it were, from either or both candidates and then bring those back as a union negotiator would to his union and say this is what they've offered, it's not as if you can deliver the votes, but if you do a good job as a negotiator, you clearly are in a position of continuing leadership, whether or not you have blocks of vote to deliver or not. You have the leverage of those votes for which you have to return something. You just mentioned the kind of things you want to return.
That's right. And one thing I think the community should remember is that, Harvey ran three or four times before he ever got elected. And I think what this campaign has done is taken this giant bull, and it's represented by the establishment. Feinstein and Kopp are the establishment. We've taken a 4x4 and we've hit him over the head and the bull stands there stunned. And it may decide to charge again, may totally disregard us, and we may have a very unhappy candidate who thought they were going to get progressive and gay support, not get gay support and progressive support. And there, we may have to go another election. I think the community has to face up to that very unfortunate alternate, that neither of the candidates will really want to do anything. They feel that they can, the candidates feel they can do very superficial things, that Quentin Kopp feels he can go to the Twin Peaks bar at 1:30 in the morning and slap backs and glad hand people and shake hands around and be a good old fella. And Dianne Feinstein, on the day after the election, can call 40 gay people who consider themselves leaders and say, "Hi, this is Dianne. Will you jump on board now and support me?" In neither case are the candidates talking about substantive issues, especially things of importance to the gay community. They just feel they have to come say, "Hello, I've touched you, I've recognized you," and then walk away. And I don't think gay participation politics is that. I think it's being part of the process.
Neither of them is running for empress, where they think they can win by coming to our parties and blowing kisses. You've identified, I think, the issues as the main issues of concern as the police and rent.
That's correct.
Which in a way is kind of like security and safety on the street and having a home to go back to.
And we shouldn't overlook participation in other commissions as vacancies become available. I don't mean clean out every commission, but as vacancies become available, lesbians and gay men should be available for appointment as a percentage of our input in city government and a percentage of the population.
Okay, I'm sure that if people stay tuned to KSAN News, they'll be hearing about the moves that David Scott and other progressive leaders in the city will be making as the mayoral runoff continues and the runoff for other offices as well. What about you personally, David? What comes in 1980? In whatever terms you want to describe it.
I will not announce my candidacy for anything today because you will not call me back as a guest, and I'd love to come back.
But until you announce it, you're not a candidate. So what are you considering?
I know I'd like to say active in elected politics. I also know that I think the one important thing that we need to do is get gay rights legislation through the legislature. And I frankly think that we can do that if we have someone who's an upfront gay person, whether it's a lesbian or whether it's a gay man, in the legislature. And I think that there's a tremendous process that goes on when you sit down with your fellow legislators, or for that matter with your fellow commissioners on the Board of Permanent Appeals, and know people on a one-to-one basis. And that would give us the necessary edge to get the legislation not only out of committee, but get it through the adjoining house of the legislature and signed by the governor. I don't think it'll happen until, in fact, we have an upfront lesbian or gay man in the legislature.
And that's what you're considering.
That's what I'm thinking about.
Okay. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great
here
to be
this
here,
morning,
Randy.
David Scott. This is The Gay Life on KSAN. And our next guest this morning is Quentin Crisp, the author of the renowned autobiography, The Naked Civil Servant, which many of you probably saw in the public broadcasting system in the last several months. Good morning, Quentin.
Good morning.
A lot of people have varying feelings about the use of the word gay for homosexual. How do you feel about that?
Well, I daren't knock it. I daren't make fun of it because I have nothing else to suggest in its place. I think it is a little worrying that the word gay does tend to bring to mind that effort to be happy, which is different from happiness itself. And a lot of gay communities, when they're together, they do give out this gaiety as though it were hard work, almost a hysterical kind of gaiety. And I think it's a pity if the word gay comes in the minds of the rest of the world to represent this characteristic.
What characteristic is that? Partying too hard?
Yes, trying too hard to be lively, to be jovial, to be sociable, which I think you do find in groups of effeminate gay people.
That's an interesting point, because in your book you talk a lot about the difference between homosexuals in general and the specific problems that effeminate gay men have. Mm. Having traveled now and done the show in Australia and England, where you live, and now bringing it to the U.S., do you have any observations about the difference in the styles of effeminacy and the ways in which gay men deal with varying degrees of effeminacy in those three different English-speaking nations? Well, that's assuming you think it's English that we speak here in America.
That's right. Yes, I did offer to learn the language when I first came to America, but was forbidden to do this. So now I only speak English the way I've always spoken it. Well, in England, the gaiety tends to be more conspicuous in some way, or else those who are not conspicuous are not noticed at all. There isn't the same uniform that is worn by gay people in New York.
Which uniform is that?
Well, all the gay people in New York have kitchen tablecloth shirts and pre-ruined jeans and tractor boots and small moustaches. And if you go to some of the restaurants...
Don't they ever take off the kitchen tablecloths and put on shirts with alligators?
I've never seen them do this. If you go to certain restaurants in New York, you only know that you haven't stumbled by mistake into a building site canteen because they all look so clean. Uh-huh. That's how you know they haven't been working. But they propagate this manly image, which I'm sure suits some of them absolutely, but you can't really feel that it suits all of them.
But is it really all of them? I mean, aren't you saying that all of the visible gay people are wearing the same uniform? But isn't that what makes them visible? Aren't there still people who dress in a variety of fashions?
Yes, of course there are. There are people who dress the way they've always dressed before the word gay was ever mentioned. Yes, that's absolutely true, and that is so all over the world. The difference is that the gay people that you can recognize in England have gone much beyond merely looking outdoor, healthy, manly. They've gone into emblems of cruelty, and there are restaurants and public houses in England where they are dressed in their chains and in their leather clothes.
You could find that in San Francisco or New York as well. I mean, we have those different scenes in each of these areas.
Ah, yes. Them I didn't see in New York.
Well, maybe your agents are sheltering you from a whole side of American life.
That's right. That could easily be. In Australia, Sydney is said to be the third gayest city in the world.
After
San Francisco and Amsterdam. But there you do not see any uniforms, or if I did, I didn't know I was seeing them. But they do have endless marches and endless protests. And I think some of the states have laws which protect them, and some of the states don't. And I didn't know which they were.
The uniform that you referred to in this coast is known as the Castro clone outfit. And it's very interesting because if you suggest to many of the people wearing it, not all, but to many, that in fact it's another form of drag, different from going in drag in a dress, but still a form of drag, they'll greatly resent it. But isn't it simply a form of the exhibitionism which you say is a drug that requires ever more massive doses?
No, I don't think so, or to a lesser extent. I think it is a way of being together. I think it makes them feel that they are part of a body of people and that they have more safety and perhaps even more power if they all move together, think together, work together for some common object, and that the clothes are a symbol of this oneness.
What about differences over the years? You said in your book that in the 20s and 30s that English homosexuals tried to divest themselves of any signs of effeminacy as if it were lice.
Mm.
Have you noticed any change in the last three or four decades?
Oh, yes. The young people now in London wear absolutely anything. Anything goes. Fancy dress is national costume. And there is no way in certain parts of London, like Chelsea, that you could find anything to wear which would cause any comment whatsoever. And this has nothing to do with being gay. It is to do with being young. They wish to feel free, and their weird clothes are a symbol of their freedom.
What about camp? You refer to that as a fossilized form of behavior. That it.
Yes, I think it is, and certainly the drag artists, for instance, that appear on the stage in London or in small back rooms behind bars and public houses, they have exactly the same gestures and exactly the same patter, except that the patter is now more outrageous, as they had 30 years ago. There is this parade of bitchiness, of vanity, but now it has got much more ferocious, and the people in the front rows of a show like that are savaged by the performer, which was not so when I was young, certainly.
Do you think that form of behavior is in any way anti-woman, that it represents a negative valuation of that, or is it an attempt to imitate something positively that's just become...
If any group of people envies another group, given half a chance, they will always imitate the worst characteristics of the group they admire. And I've never seen a drag act in which anyone endeavored to be a nice woman. Though we do have acts like Hinge and Bracket, and they represent bitchy women, but rather parochial women, rather old-fashioned women.
The sense of envy, do you think that that's got anything to do behind the straight toughs who make fun of mincing homosexuals and then proceed to beat them up, either with or without the benefit of having obtained some sexual gratification from them, then going ahead to beat them up?
I think everybody needs somebody to beat up. Everybody piles up a certain amount of bitterness.
Isn't that why all those men are wearing leather and chains?
Well, I think that is a dream, personally, and that if you really got to know them, they would be just like people. It's a parade of a cruelty which they don't really feel, or half the time it's that. But, you see, everybody needs somebody who is worse than they are. Everybody needs somebody that no one can blame them for setting upon, for picking on. And in certain societies, it is the gay people. So that if you went back and said to your friends that you'd thrown someone down on the pavement and trampled on them, they would express surprise until you said he was gay, and then they would say, oh, I see. So the behavior would be understandable. You wouldn't have lost face. You would have been able to explain to people why you'd given way to the rage and the violence. But you feel it actually independent of the object. You feel it against the world. You feel it against your parents who try to restrict you. You feel it against your wife who doesn't love you, against the dog who doesn't do as you say, against your employers who don't give you any kind of preferment.
And in politics you always blame the incumbents.
That's right.
And I suppose parents have been incumbents for hundreds of thousands of years, so
that's right.
We go heavily on them. What about it? Well, in this country, there's a media image when you see gay people represented almost always as whites, although in fact that's not true. There are Latino and black and Native American gays and so forth. But there is some, for instance, in San Francisco, people don't like to talk about it, but there's some resentment among some of the city's black and Latin populations, especially among young kids who don't understand what's going on, who see gay as equal to white and privileged. Not aware, perhaps, that there are many of their own brothers and sisters who are, in fact, in the scene, perhaps not wearing the uniforms that you described so that they're not as visible. Britain has its own shares of racial problems. Do you see any interaction between is the gay scene mixed racially in Britain, or is there the same kind of social segregation that exists, say, with regard to West Indian blacks or Indians and Pakistanis, which seem to be the...
Well, I suppose people who know about the subject are aware that gay people come from anywhere.
Right.
But, yes, there's in a play or on television or something like that, no one would make the gay actors a black, because this would be something which would cause an outcry at once from all the liberals and all the black people. How dare you say that black people are gay? In fact, then what they would say immediately is, how dare you say all black people are gay? Because any image which you put onto television is considered to be universal. If you wrote a play in which there was a murder, and you cast about for some setting and thought, oh, well, the murderer could be a florist, you would immediately get letters saying, I don't know what makes you think all florists are murderers. Immediately. So, of course, you never say that black people are gay, because you will get immediately complaints that you've said that all black people are gay.
What about in the day-to-day, or night-to-night life, I should say, in the clubs and public
houses?
Oh, there,
I would say...
Is there mixing, or is it separated?
I think it's a bit... I think it would be a bit uneasy. I'm sure there are black people who go to gay clubs, but I can imagine that it's uneasy, because they all feel persecuted for different reasons. And there probably is an idea that you could seem slightly less persecuted. Or, as you say, that black people say they are gay and they are less persecuted than we are who are gay and black. So there are veils upon veils.
We hear a lot of this about who's more persecuted.
That's
it can
right.
turn into a perverse parlor game. This is The Gay Life on KSAN, and we're talking with British author Quentin Crisp. You've said that you decided to shift homosexuality from being a burden to being a cause, and now it's a show.
That's right. Yes, that is, I think, the natural progress. You take what you are and you turn it into a cause, which lightens the burden immediately, because you can then say, I am not indulging myself, I am saving the world. And when you are a bit older, you realize this is absolute nonsense. One is not a cause. Certainly I am not a cause. I'm only representing myself. And this has to be said.
But you could be a spokesperson for a cause.
Yes, I could, in a sense. And whatever life you live, obviously, you do represent something to other people. If you live your life conspicuously, you will be either conspicuously English, and people can say you're giving England a bad name. You will always be thought to be part of a group of some kind, and your behavior will be thought to bring discredit, or possibly credit, to it.
Do you receive invitations to speak at gay rights rallies or other political meetings?
I never have received invitations to speak at political meetings, because I don't really understand politics. I'm outside them. And therefore, what I say, I think, would be absolutely beside the point.
Well, I think that you may be outside of politics in a conventional electoral sense, but in terms of the politics of experience, the kind of existentialist choice that you talk about to continue to make, I think you say, blindingly conspicuous, what's already obviously clear, is a form of politics on its own. It's a form of street politics. It's a form of interactional politics. You used, it seemed to me, as you walked the streets of London in the 20s and 30s, made up, hennaed, nail-polished, and so forth, you used your appearance as a lever of power to upset people who would be upset by it and to please those who understood you well enough to please. And that's politics, isn't it?
Oh, well, it may be, and I certainly mustn't say it isn't. I didn't know it was politics. I merely thought...
You said you didn't know that you were an existentialist. You just thought you were...
Brazening it out, right. That's right, yes. That is what I thought. I had no philosophical education and no political education. So I thought...
So you're a natural.
I thought I was telling people what they so desperately wanted to know, which surprised me because I am absolutely indifferent to what sexual behavior is natural to the people who are walking past me in the street. I can't see how anyone can care. The number of occasions on which the sexuality of a total stranger matter to you are very few and very peculiar. I mean, you can sit on a bus with someone without knowing whether it's a man or a woman, without caring. And anyone who has an appearance which is between somewhere between the sexes has no objection to being called sir or madam alternately.
Okay, but while you were out there, you never... I mean, you were not going out in drag as a woman.
No.
So your intention was... to show yourself as a different kind of man.
My intention was to live out all the attributes of my nature.
Okay. Now that, it seems to me, is a very political intention in a society where we receive constant signals not to express that nature. And the decision to express it is political. Perhaps on a micro level or a very personal level, but then when you write a book about it and become the subject of an award-winning screenplay, and now go out in your show, it seems to me that it is political, and politics of the best kind, which I commend you for.
We agreed that everybody is a minority of one.
Yes.
Well, that is
I'll
my
take that.
Point of view.
All right. You are perhaps one of the most eloquent minorities of one that we've been graced with. Thank you very much for being with us here this morning on The Gay Life, Quentin Crisp.
Thank you for listening.
Aaron Shuren's poetic drama Line Drawing is having its premiere the last two weekends in November, 8:30 p.m., at the Performance Space, 1350 Waller Street. This highly unusual theater piece by one of the Bay Area's most original poets, a guest on The Gay Life several months ago, offers an intimate view into a relationship where two characters walk the tightrope of love and struggle on stage with the actual strings of their emotions. In Line Drawing, the language of love is truly alive. For details, call 861-7794. That's 861-7794. A reminder that on the evening of November 27th, there will be a memorial candlelight procession leaving Castro Street at 8 o'clock and going to City Hall, so bring your candles. That about wraps it up on The Gay Life this morning. Our guests have been Quentin Crisp, David Scott, and we've also given you a repeat of a revised version of White Knight, Black Dish. The Gay Life is engineered by Rick Sadle and produced by me, Randy Alfred. I also write a column, Taking Sides, for The Sentinel, which is available in gay neighborhoods throughout San Francisco. If you're listening on Sunday morning, the show will be repeated late Monday night at 1 a.m. So please tell a friend about The Gay Life on KSAN San Francisco.